You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a case at the U.S. Supreme Court next term will determine whether people with domestic violence restraining orders will have the right to own guns. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a piece of art called The Land of the Freed Up Woman.
The 1970s were the height of the second wave of feminism, when women in the U.S. were advocating for equal rights and opportunities to men. As Molly Honkin tells us, it was during this time that one woman expressed her feminist views by creating art made out of a unique medium, bras.
Artist Marge Engelman has spent much of her life in Wisconsin. The walls of her Madison apartment reflect that time, as they're covered with countless pieces of art.
This is Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. The Big Bear. Anyway, I'll show you around.
Despite Engelman's own works of art that currently adorn her apartment's walls, she says she wasn't always an artist.
When I was in grade school, a teacher had implied that I did not have artistic ability. So I took that seriously.
Engelman says she never visited art galleries until she was 38, and she definitely didn't make her own art. That changed when she discovered that the University of Wisconsin Extension offered courses in contemporary art.
I found out there was a program in the School of Home Economics, and it was called Related Art. So I registered. I was about 48 years old, so I was a different kind of student.
Through this program, Engelman got her master's degree in art after 2 years. She taught introductory art courses for a few years and was then appointed as the director of outreach at UW-Green Bay. Engelman says around this time, change was taking root.
The feminist movement came along, and I became a flaming feminist because I felt quite a bit of discrimination growing up and also working, because women weren't valued as much as men.
Engelman says she was inspired by this moment. It led her to start a child care center on UW-Green Bay's campus for students and faculty. Plus, she was still creating art, including a historical piece she created in 1971 that was inspired by the bra-burning feminists.
But then it was about that time that I got the idea for the bra banner, and I called it the Land of the Freed Up Woman.
The banner looks like the American flag, but features stripes made out of red velveteen and 20 white padded bras. It also alters the stars in the corner of the flag by replacing them with foam modeled after birth control pills.
The pill, a contraceptive pill, had just come out, and so I decided I could visualize that in the field of blue.
She created the flag in response to her experiences with discrimination. During her time in administration at UW-Green Bay, Engelman says she was the only woman on staff.
There were things that were said to me and opportunities I didn't have because I was a woman. And I thought people should start thinking.
At the age of 96, Engelman is still creating art out of her Wisconsin home.
I have made a sewing center here in the bathroom. So I put my sewing machine here.
Some of her art now relates to more tame themes like nursery rhymes.
Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow.
But like the bra flag, she continues to create pieces that are politically motivated.
Molly Honkin brought us that story on Marge Engelman's bra flag. The art itself is part of the Wisconsin 101 Project, which tells our state's history through objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, the U.S. Supreme Court last month agreed to take up a case relating to whether people with domestic violence restraining orders have the right to own guns. The case will land at the Supreme Court in the next term. a federal judge ruled that a 1994 law preventing people with those domestic violence restraining orders goes against, quote, our nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation, end quote. History is at the heart of the case because the Supreme Court ruled in Bruin versus New York that restrictions on guns must be consistent with historical tradition. All this is part of a broader push among conservatives on the court to advance the idea of originalism, a doctrine that argues we have to interpret the Constitution as the founders would have when they were alive. We're talking about this Supreme Court case that will decide whether people with domestic violence restraining orders can be barred from owning guns. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Should people with domestic violence restraining orders be allowed to purchase and own firearms? When would it be fair to take away someone's right to own a firearm? What's your reaction to recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions on Second Amendment issues? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Susan Liebel is a professor of political science at St. Joseph's University and an expert on the Second Amendment. Susan, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Rob.
All right, a lot of layers here. Let's start with this 1994 law at the center of the case. In a nutshell, what does this federal law do?
It wasn't a nutshell. It was enormous. The Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994 was just pages and pages of different kinds of measures that were meant to be tough on crime. President Clinton was trying to show that Democrats were tough on crime. And so this included things like 10,000 new police officers and almost $10 billion in funding for prisons. But it also called for a Violence Against Women Act and tried to find ways, including the creation of the National Domestic Violence Hotline and requiring states to enforce restraining orders in other states, to get at violence against women across the country. There was a Safe Streets Act that was part of it as well. So it was a big omnibus crime law, and it also included these protections for women and a little bit more of a focus on things like battered women's shelters.
The part of the law involving saying, hey, if you have this domestic violence restraining order, this federal law prevents you from owning firearms. That's this case now advancing to the Supreme Court. Can you give us a background on this Texas case that is now headed to the Supreme Court?
Yeah, it's really tough. In 2019, a Texas man had an argument with his girlfriend in a parking lot. Mr. Zaki Rahimi knocked the woman to the ground. And as he dragged her back to his car, she hit her head on the car's dashboard. And later in a telephone call, and I think this is really an important fact, Rahimi threatened the woman that he would shoot her if she told anyone about the assault. Now, a few months later, she did get a domestic violence restraining order against Mr. Rahimi. And that barred him, as you said, under that 1994 law, from possessing a gun, and warned him that doing so while the order was in effect would be a federal felony. And about a year later, while that order was still in effect, he was a suspect in a series of shootings. And when the police came in and searched his home pursuant to a warrant, they found a pistol, a rifle, and ammunition with a copy of the restraining order as well. So he was charged with violating the federal ban on the possession of a firearm by anyone who is the subject of a domestic violence restraining order. And he pleaded guilty to that and was sentenced to just over 6 years in prison.
Now, gun laws have changed, or the way the courts view gun laws changed in this Bruin case I mentioned. Can you talk about this standard established by the Supreme Court majority on the historic nature of gun laws and how it applies now to this case making its way through the system and to the Supreme Court?
Of course, Rob. You know, usually these things sound so academic, but this particular case shows how they're not in any way academic. They affect everyday lives across the country, because what happens is the Fifth Circuit does rule on this case. And when the Bruin case comes out, they redo the case with a different answer, which we can get to later. But what the Bruin case said was that rather than asking the question, is there a compelling state interest in regulating guns such that we can ask a gun owner to comply? For example, rules about concealed carry, which was the subject of the Bruin case. And New York State had had a law for 100 years that said you could have concealed carry, but you had to apply for it and have a cause for needing it. What the court said was, we're not going to ask the question, is there a compelling reason? The new question we're going to ask was there a law in either 1791, when the Constitution was passed, or 1868, when another set of framers revised the Constitution after the Civil Law, would one of those two audiences have had a law that is analogous to what New York State has? And if they don't, if they can't find such a law, if the history and tradition of those two time periods, the 18th and 19th century, don't have it, well, then the people of New York State can't pass that law, and so the law that's stood for 100 years in New York was overturned by the Supreme Court.
Now, there's how this clashes with this current case. Domestic violence laws, domestic violence restraining orders, that was not a concept. That wasn't a thing we had, right, in the early days of the Republic. Can you talk about how applying that kind of historic standard to something like domestic violence bring us to where we are?
Yeah, I mean, look, originalism, which is what the justices are using, promises to interrogate the text and be disinterested. It says, like, look, we have this sacred text and we're not imposing our beliefs on it. We're just looking at the past. But I think it's really important for us to remember that this idea of originalism only came about quite recently in the 1980s. And so it's not something that the court has been doing for very long. But this court, the Roberts Court, is very committed to originalism. And the problem with it is that at the time of the founding, 1791, and the revision of the Constitution, in fact, men were very much allowed to beat their wives. In fact, it was their entitlement to be able to coerce them into desired domestic habits, which is a quote from that time period. And the rape of a married woman by a man was not a crime. So, and in fact, the rape of a married woman by a man other than her husband was a property crime of man against man. And this is because in the 18th and 19th centuries, married women and most women had very few rights in the United States. And that means that if we're only looking at analogous laws, we won't find any protecting domestic violence. We'll find the opposite. The history and tradition of the United States until the 1970s is to give men the right, in fact, to coerce their wives by beating them or to rape them. So it's a very tough judicial methodology if you care about violence against women or other groups that were not considered at the time of the two foundings.
We're talking to Susan Liebel, professor of political science at St. Joseph's University, looking at a case that will decide whether people under domestic violence restraining orders have the right to bear arms, and changes in gun law interpretation at the Supreme Court that allowed this case to make it to the nation's highest court. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're willing to share a story, if you're a survivor of domestic violence or you work with survivors, what do you think of this idea of, you know, banning gun ownership for people with a domestic violence restraining order? What are your thoughts on this case as it heads to the Supreme Court? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Our talk with Susan Liebel, professor of political science at St. Joseph's University, looking at a U.S. Supreme Court case they've decided to take up that will decide whether people under domestic violence restraining orders can be barred from owning firearms. A federal law does just that. It is up for debate now at the court, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Should it be legal to have laws that bar people with domestic violence restraining orders from having guns. Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Jordan is with us in Stevens Point. Jordan, hi.
Good afternoon.
What did you want to bring up, Jordan?
So if I'm understanding the originalist doctrine correctly, wouldn't that mean that today only white male land-owning citizens would be able to vote? But in all of these other aspects of interpreting the Constitution, it is a living document that can keep up with our day and age. Why is it particular to the Second Amendment that we are anchored to the original ratification of the Constitution?
Jordan, thanks for the call. Susan.
It's a great question. So in terms of the vote, there's an explicit change to the Constitution that happens in 1868, which is adding the 15th Amendment, which says that, in fact, the vote is extended to people, not women, but it is extended to all men in the United States. So that's how originalists would get around that. And then they would point to the amendment of the document again to explicitly include women's voting. So voting isn't the example that would be the strongest, but Jordan's idea is there, that, and it is true, that in all things that are not explicitly stated, there seems to be more room for modernity. But what has happened, and this is only since 2008, and I can't overstate that many conservative people have been on the Supreme Court for 200 years, and they didn't write about originalism. Originalism is something that is very new and only dates to the Reagan 80s and attempts to change a methodology that has existed for a long time. So I think there is, or was before 2008, some sort of shared understanding of that. In 2008, people reread what they had agreed upon previously was something about militias, and they say that it is an individual right that cannot be compromised. And that is very new, Jordan. It goes with this radical originalism that is introduced last year in the Bruin case. So we have sort of the start of the originalist Second Amendment in the Heller case in 2008, and then we see it kind of expand in ways that I think nobody would have imagined, insisting that there be a historical analogy for a law.
And briefly, thanks for that call, Jordan. That's something I wanted to dig into a bit more. We have this, as of last year, this historic standard. We have to establish that there was a comparable law in the early days of the Republic. Does that happen with anything but guns right now? Is that something we do with other constitutionally enumerated rights?
Well, it happened with abortion as well. The abortion case followed that exact kind of approach. And I think we are hearing hints of it in cases that involve LGBTQ people, because, in fact, we have a history and tradition of, in fact, disrespect for LGBTQ people in 1791 and 1868, in which often they are criminalized and not judged to be as citizens. But it honestly, Rob, all the other amendments, First Amendment, there are compromises to the First Amendment. You do not have, as Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes put it, the right to cry fire in a crowded theater. And in fact, we restrict people's speech all of the time. We restrict people in many ways. Something has happened with guns in which the narrative has been that guns equal freedom, and that they're more important than, for example, First Amendment rights to speak. So we see, for example, the clash between First Amendment speech rights and guns. If we want to go to a protest and hold up a sign that says, "I want X," will you feel the same in that crowd if there are people there with guns? Will it, in fact, affect people's First Amendment rights? Will they be more careful about what they say in the public sphere if they think that everybody in the public sphere has a gun?
Time for one more caller. Liz is with us in Lyons. Liz, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Liz?
So in more detail, let's say a police officer has domestic violence However, they're not holding him accountable, and yet he's still able to carry a gun. That would be my situation. More detail in that, I would want to know how can we make those people accountable and keep them from getting a gun through their job?
Liz, thanks for the call. I'm sorry that you are in that situation. First of all, Susan, Liz says, victim of domestic violence, her husband in law enforcement. I guess it illustrates that these are not just academic court issues, as you said earlier. These are things that affect real people.
No, and Liz, I'm very sorry to hear about your situation. What is encouraging is that Congress in 1994 thought about this and listed situations like this as the reason for creating this rule. And I think the thing that's very important for me to communicate is that the majority opinion in the appeals court below really trivializes the kind of experience that Liz is having. Instead, they see Congress as the threat, not the people with guns who are beating people up in a parking lot and threatening them. Judge Wilson foresees the government stripping speeders or people who don't recycle or who drive an electric vehicle of their right to bear arms. And that is really making fun of what the heart of this case is. None of the domestic violence statistics, and they are horrifying, are in this case. I mean, 20% of female intimate partner homicide victims who had restraining orders were killed within 2 days of the order being issued, and 33 were killed within a month. There is a concurrence in this opinion which talks about restraining orders as tactical devices used in divorce proceedings.
I will have to leave it there. Susan Liebel was with us talking about domestic violence and gun rights. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the FDA granted full approval for a new Alzheimer's drug. We'll talk to a Wisconsin dementia expert about the potential benefits and risks of the treatment. First, a group of scientists this week says our planet Earth has entered a new human-caused epoch, the Anthropocene. That comes from an international working group of geologists that are recommending that the scientific community recognize the Anthropocene as beginning in the 1950s. If the Anthropocene Working Group's recommendation is taken up, this would be the first official geologic shift of its kind since the dawn of civilization, and the first that scientists say humanity sparked on its own. As a marker of the change, the group says the area around a lake in Canada shows a unique layer of plutonium from nuclear bomb tests and fly ash from burning fossil fuels. Our next guest teaches classes on the topic of the Anthropocene era, what it means, and how we define it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this concept that a human activity is causing a new era in the history of our planet? What would you like to know about people's impact on the planet? What do you want to see us do to adapt to a changing climate here on Earth? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Elizabeth Hennessy is an associate professor of history and environmental studies at UW-Madison. She teaches a class called Global Environmental History, How Do We Live in the Anthropocene? Elizabeth, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here, Rob. Thanks for having me.
This concept, this idea of the Anthropocene, it's been around for, I think, 20 years-ish or so now. I want to start, Elizabeth, with the significance, as you see it, of this group of scientists who are, I think, really thinking in the long term here, saying, yeah, we're entering into this new era. What do you make of what we're hearing from this Anthropocene working group?
Yeah, you're correct. They have been talking about this idea for about 20 years, and I think it really took off about 15 years ago. There's been a lot of scholarship on this Anthropocene idea, a lot of debate about it too. I think the big picture that the geologists have really pushed forward is that we have entered this human-caused epic, right? So right, we are in the Holocene right now and have been in the Holocene for the last 11,000, almost 12,000 years. And they're saying that in the 1950s, we have kind of reached a tipping point when all of the kind of, you know, the pollution, all of the kinds of things like climate change, species extinctions have pushed us into a new geological age in which we really see human impact on the world. And I think that this is it's really significant because I think it's very much of our moment, kind of recognizing the impacts that humans have had on the world, but also in an environmental sense, thinking about, well, what do we do about this?
I think with geologists, part of the story here is that they're thinking, okay, our counterparts 10 million years from now, when they do core samples of the Earth, are they going to see a layer deposited that shows this big change? I think a lot of us are thinking in a shorter time horizon, Elizabeth. As you talk about the Anthropocene with your colleagues and students, what kind of things do you have your eye on?
It's a great question. The reason that they have found the 1950s to be this kind of starting point moment is because there are plutonium radioisotopes all around the world that have settled into, you know, the lake bed in this situation, but also on the floor of the ocean. And those have a half-life of something like 24,000 years. So 100,000 years from now, people will be able to still see those traces. And that's a really remarkable thing. And it's a really hard thing for us to get our heads around thinking about geological time spans. And so one of the issues that I think about with my students are, you know, like they're debating right now, is it going to be 1950? Is it going to be 1952? And from a geological standpoint, it's kind of a moot point because it's like saying, well, did it start on a Tuesday or a Wednesday? You know, like their geological time is so vast that a couple of years really isn't going to make a huge difference in what we see. And so when I talk with my students about the Anthropocene idea, we talk more about the kinds of processes and the reasons why humans relate to our natural environments in the way that we do today and how those got started. What are those impacts? And trying to trace out those histories.
This concept of the Anthropocene, whatever the geologists end up saying about it, a lot of fields are working with this concept. What are some of the debates about, you know, whether we are in a new era shaped by human activity?
Yeah, well, there's been a huge amount of debate in the environmental humanities, which is my field. One of the biggest debates is about how we name this Anthropocene. And so there are a lot of different other potential names that have been tossed out there. There are folks who say, well, we should name it after the era of capitalism and call it the Capitalocene, in which case maybe it didn't start in 1950, but maybe it started 500 years ago with the advent of capitalism and the transatlantic slave trade. And so that pushes us then to think a little bit differently in terms of what is driving this new human age and what the main things we should be looking at are. So if you think about it as starting in the 1950s, historians call that the Great Acceleration. And so we see in the 1950s, this is the era when, you know, my grandparents and many others started having, everyone had electricity, phones, washer dryers, TVs, refrigerators. And so electricity usage went up. We all started driving cars. And so fossil fuel use has gone up dramatically. And so there's a lot that has happened in the mid 20th century besides all the nuclear test bombs that scientists are thinking about right now. But all of those processes that are being called out by geologists in the 1950s, because they leave a really nice geological trace, actually have a much longer history. And so that's something that historians, and I try to get my students to really think about, well, what are those longer histories and who is involved in this Anthropocene? Because one of the other debates about the word is that, you know, if it's the human age, then are we all in it in the same way, right? Is it all humanity that is to blame for this or at fault? Or is it different human groups, right? Different classes, people from different nationalities. And so there's a lot of debate about who's responsible for the Anthropocene.
Talking to Elizabeth Hennessy, Associate Professor of History and Environmental Studies at UW-Madison, looking at the Anthropocene, this idea that we are in a new era in the timeline of the Earth driven by human activity, human change, including climate change. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your reflections on that idea. What does that make you think about, worry about, maybe your questions on how we define this? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi. You know, I guess it all makes sense to me. We can't have all this carbon buried under the Earth's surface for millions of years and then pumped into the atmosphere and not expect an impact. And I know people want to say that all of the climate change concerns are new, but, I talked to your screener. I said I remembered reading about an article from the early 1900s that expressed concerns about climate change. And when I was looking up a little while I was waiting, I came back to an article that talked about as early as 1824, a mathematician and physicist expressed concerns about or recognized that the atmosphere was warm, not just from the sun. And then in the mid-1800s, people started expressing concerns about climate change.
Lisa, thanks a lot for that call. And Elizabeth, I think if you run this idea to a lot of people about a new era driven by human activity, like Lisa, the first thing they might think of would be climate change and global warming. How does that fit into our conversation about the Anthropocene? I think we've, Elizabeth, are you still there?
I think yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Go ahead. Go for it. We're having some issues with our connection. Let's take a little break. Elizabeth Hennessy stays with us from UW-Madison. We're talking about the concept of the Anthropocene, new era in Earth's history, driven by changes caused by people. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does that idea mean to you? We've got this geological working group saying, yeah, we recommend that, yes, officially, we are in a new epoch starting in the 1950s. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lisa, thanks for calling in with those thoughts. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Elizabeth Hennessy, Associate Professor of History and Environmental Studies at UW-Madison, talking about a statement by an international working group of geologists this week saying the planet Earth is entering a new geological era caused by human activity and the wider concept of this Anthropocene. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Elizabeth, we heard from Lisa in Madison earlier, who brought up climate change as a central part of this story of a changing Earth driven by human activity. How central is climate change to this idea of the Anthropocene?
Yeah, Lisa's right. It's absolutely central to the idea of the Anthropocene. And I think that one of the things that the geologists are able to do is really kind of play up the significance of climate change and the fact that if we have tipped ourselves into a new geological epoch, those reverberations are going to be felt, you know, far, far into the future.
Lisa, thanks a lot for that call. Back to your calls now. Carl is with us in Shawano. Carl, hi.
Hello, sir. I'd like to ask your caller, what good's it going to do about climate change if the three biggest nations in the world have not signed the treaty, India, Russia, and China? Unless we all sign on, it's not going to do any good.
Carl, thanks for the call. Elizabeth, that takes us to, we're declaring ourselves in this new era, in part because of climate change. What kind of things can we do about it?
Yeah, well, he's right that the geologists are not politicians. And so they're calling attention to this only goes so far. And so there are a lot of critics who kind of push back and say, well, you know, we can call this era whatever we like, but the political questions are still very much on the table.
Carl, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Paul joins us now in Menominee. Paul, hi.
Hi. The biggest cause of most of these issues that we're talking about is overpopulation. Our population has tripled since the 1940s, human population. And unless we find a way to somehow encourage people to have small families, we are just going to eat away at all the life, animal life. We've already, half the animals have already gone extinct in the last 50 years. And so there's a lot needs to be done, and I don't know what kind of programs you could get people to get themselves involved in to have less children, but That's probably going to be the most effective thing you can do.
Paul, thanks for the call. Elizabeth, I know there's a lively debate over, you know, the number of people versus the resource consumption per capita. But one of Paul's main points there, he mentioned animal extinctions. And we've been I've talked to other guests who've talked about how we're in a new era of mass extinction. Is that one of the signs of the Anthropocene that you say in your class talk about with your students?
Yeah, exactly. We are in the so-called sixth mass extinction event. There have been five previous ones. And the last one was when the dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago. And that, of course, was caused, we think, when an asteroid hit the Yucatan. But of course, we can't blame an asteroid for these more recent extinction events that are happening now. We haven't quite lost 50% yet, but people project that we will, over the course of this century, we could lose up to 75% of the current biodiversity in the world. So this is another one of the major things that the Anthropocene concept is calling attention to.
Thanks a lot for that call. Elizabeth, I mentioned your class title at the outset. I keep coming back to it. How do we live in the Anthropocene as part of it? And now this year we've seen unprecedented things like extended periods of wildfire smoke showing up here in Wisconsin, this vast heat wave spreading from border to border, basically, in the southern United States. What kind of questions do you have about how we live in the Anthropocene and how we adapt to this fundamental change?
Yeah, these are the really difficult and thorny questions that it's hard to have one answer, because if anyone did, we would be doing that, I think. And so this is something that my students and I spend a lot of time debating, because there are lots of different potential solutions on the table out there, things from geoengineering and thinking about how to, shoot mirrors literally up into the sky to try and reflect back some of the sun's energy to slow down global warming, things like seeding the ocean with iron to make it less acidic. And then, you know, we have also the other really interesting thing about the Anthropocene and this Crawford Lake designation of the kind of core area, which is up near Toronto, is that it's an Indigenous site. And so there are a lot of Indigenous scholars these days who are saying, you know, we've been living through these kind of apocalyptic times that many of us in the West are waking up to over the last 20 years. They've been living through that for centuries. And so looking to Indigenous scholars, Indigenous scientists, to think about how to handle adaptation, how to handle what they call collective continuance, is another major thing that I think we should be putting more attention on.
And that points to something you touched on earlier, the effects of this change, of climate change and other impacts of the Anthropocene, not evenly distributed among human societies, among individuals within the same society. What kind of questions does that raise?
Yeah, so that raises a lot of questions about, you know, who were the industrialized nations first? What were the motivations for industrialization? Who's profiting from that industrialization? You know, a lot of these things, most Americans are very much caught up in this kind of society. You know, I drive a car, I consume all of the electricity and whatnot that everyone else does. But how is it that we kind of reconcile our individual consumption with the profit motivation of many of the corporations that provide those services for us? So there's this issue within a nation, a developed nation like the United States, but then there are also really big gaps in the levels of consumption, both within the United States, but then also between what's often gets lost as the global North and the global South, right? So thinking about inequalities and different patterns of consumption in different among different communities around the globe too.
Talking to Elizabeth Hennessy, Associate Professor of History and Environmental Studies at UW-Madison, talking about a new era in Earth's timeline, the Anthropocene. Back to your calls now. Daryl is with us in Menominee Falls. Daryl, hi.
Hi. I would like to say that it seems in this country we live with such an adolescent mentality toward something. We don't want to be responsible for the way we live. People laugh off climate change. The scientists are trying to bring this up as a scam. I don't know what the scam is, what the scientists are gaining. They're trying to make us aware of what's actually going on in our environment. And that it's like we don't want to be responsible for the way we live. I would hope, I'm trying to be positive, I hope that we've had enough signs now with climate change and what's going on around us that we start growing up and taking on responsibility for the taking care of the planet we live in.
Daryl, thanks a lot for the call. Elizabeth, I want to key in on one phrase there. Daryl said, I try to be positive. As you talk to students about the Anthropocene and about climate change, things like that, people mostly presumably from a younger generation, what do you hear from them as far as the optimism versus doom scale of things?
This class that I teach has the potential to be very doom centric, but I really try to talk to them about activism, about the kind of choices that they make. And one of the reasons that I really like teaching history is that we can see through all these individual people's actions that have created historical change that things aren't inevitable. And so I think that if students have more of an understanding of how things have happened in the past, how individuals have made different decisions, then they, I hope, are inspired to feel like they also will have the power to make different decisions in the future, and that this isn't necessarily a death sentence for us. But it's certainly, I'm lucky that I teach young people and that they are, I think, inherently more optimistic.
Daryl, thanks a lot for that call. Elizabeth, we've got this idea, this label of the Anthropocene. How much does this label matter? How much does it, if we agree to say, yes, we're in a new era, yes, it's human caused, what, if anything, is the impact of doing that?
This is the big question. And I think that, it can be in some ways a kind of academic pursuit role. Maybe we'll have a new geological era. And when our kids go through school, they'll learn that we're not in the Holocene anymore, but we're in this new Anthropocene era. And I think that has the potential to have people think differently about their relationships with the natural world. A generation ago, we didn't think that people could have an outsized impact on the planet, which is why a lot of these trends about mass production and mass consumption were happening, because we didn't think it would be possible to have the kind of impact that we have had. And so I think there is a general level of awareness that this will bring us. But beyond that, the political questions, I think, as we were talking about before, there's still very much political questions that are not necessarily solved just because of this broader awareness.
Elizabeth, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
That's Elizabeth Hennessy, Associate Professor of History and Environmental Studies. She joined us for a look at the concept of the Anthropocene, a new era in Earth's timeline driven by changes caused by human activity. A working group in the geology scientific community recommended, we should call it the Anthropocene starting back in the 1950s. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a UW Alzheimer's researcher about a new FDA fully approved Alzheimer's drug that could slow the progression of the disease for many people in the early stages of the illness. Still questions, concerns about the impact of the medication, the cost, and possible side effects. We'll dig into that. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back.